You've been waiting all summer for this, but finally, we're back with another episode of the Religious Studies Project. My name's Christopher Cotter, and I'm here in the Bow Bar in Edinburgh with my colleague David Robertson.
Hi.
David is a man of few words, as you'll hear, in fact, in today's interviews, because he really didn't have to say very much, did he?
I didn't, no. These were interviews done on considerable time restraints at the Open University's Contemporary Religion in Historical Context conference, and so we decided to put the two of them together.
They do bounce off each other.
I think they work very well together, actually. So that's part of the reason for that. But without further ado, let's launch into the first of these interviews, which is with John Wolfe, who's Professor of the History of Religion for the Open University.
I'll start with a very broad question. Why study religion historically? What are the benefits and uses of such an approach?
Well, I think primarily to be able to understand and appreciate how religion changes, rather than perceiving it, often misleadingly, as something that's immutable and constant. Also, I think around appreciating issues of contingency, the specific context of religious life. I mean, that may be a geographical dimension as well, but I think there's also a very sort of important historical dimension of how religious experience and belief and all the other manifestations of religion are specific in an individual context.
So what are some of the toolkit that the historian has then? What sources would you utilise? Are we talking entirely textual based or...?
Well, obviously textual based for the more remote past. As a historian primarily of 19th century Britain, I'm using archival manuscript sources a lot. I mean, materials such as the 1851 Census of Religious Worship, which is now incidentally entirely available online from the National Archives. For more recent religious history, one can be doing a lot of oral history work with older people, something for which I think there's a real need now in relation to an older generation of people with experience of very significant religious developments and changes of the 1960s to record their memories and do analysis based on that.
You mentioned the online sources there. How has the internet changed how historical research of this type takes place?
Tremendously. I mean, at a very basic level of online sources. I mean, when I was doing my doctoral work 30 years ago, there were no online library catalogues, and so one was searching for printed sources entirely through printed catalogues. And I can revisit the same topics 30 years on and identify printed sources I had missed then, simply because basic online catalogue search throws up things that one would have missed at an earlier date. Mm. But all sorts of other ways, I mean, the quantity of printed source material that is now available online means one spends more time at one's desk and less in libraries, although there's still a very significant body of material which isn't online. But nevertheless, I mean, the facility to access that immediately at one's desk and also to be able to sort of search and locate references very quickly through Google or other search engines means that the research process is very different. I mean, in some ways easier, but I think also the plethora and accessibility of information can set up new challenges, particularly in terms of focusing and inquiry and being the need to be very clear about one's research questions.
Mm. I've found in doing this material it's often a lot of it is very easily found online. It means that the stuff that isn't online becomes much harder to get hold of, actually, because sometimes it might be in some, you know, you're looking for one piece that's in one library miles away. become, you know, rather than searching through all of that material in one place and at one time, you have to make separate searches still to go to find the last few bits of the physical.
Yes, and I worry about the temptation to laziness in terms of a kind of only using the material online and therefore missing what may be the very significant document that's only still accessible on hard copy, and that clearly applies particularly to many manuscript sources which have yet to be digitised on any significant scale. So there are tremendous advantages, but I do think there are pitfalls as well.
Indeed, indeed. Maybe you could talk a little bit about how one would go about such a piece of research. I mean, maybe take one of your own research projects as an example and talk us through how you plan it and how you go about it, and then how you use the sources that you've got to create the finished piece of work. I mean, how you reconstruct and create a narrative from that.
Well, take a sort of small project. I was doing the other week, as time is short. And I was doing a lecture for Kirkdale Minster in North Yorkshire on their own history and local context in the 19th century. And I mean, the first thing is to think of what one knows already. In this case, I have a transcription of the 1851 religious census for the area, which gives immediate insights into the particular religious context. But I was then trying to locate material relating to the church and parish itself. Realised that the patrons of the parish were the University of Oxford, and that the University of Oxford, if nothing else, is likely to keep quite good records. Mm-hmm. Approached the university archives and found that they in fact have several boxes of interesting correspondence relating to their oversight as patrons of the parish. I then spent a fascinating day in the Bodleian Library in Oxford with a digital camera as well as a notepad. I mean, another advantage of technological advance of snapping choice extracts from that. I mean, gathering in many ways sort of raw data, which I then needed to take home and analyse. And one's then, one is faced with a correspondence of people engaging with very practical problems at the local level from day to day. And clearly, in producing any kind of academic analysis for a lecture or indeed for publication, one then needs to stand back from that, not to be bogged down in the detail. One could spend a long time giving a very boring account of all the to-ing and fro-ings. But when one stands back, reads the correspondence as a whole, one can then get fascinating insights as to wider problems of how an institution such as the University of Oxford is trying to support a rather struggling parish clergyman in rural Yorkshire, and how the church is working as a social and religious institution in that period.
Mm-hmm. There's been a big shift in history recent years from a sort of history as the story of great men to a sort of new history model of focusing more on individuals, you know, on the ground, the marginalised, the poor, women. I just wondered if you wanted to talk to that a little bit. Have we seen the same trend happening in religious studies?
Yes, I think so, in that historians are very interested in trying to get at what religion was really like on the ground for the average punter, whether in the Anglican pew or in the Methodist chapel in the Victorian era. The frustration can often be that the sources may not tell you a great deal about that. You tend to feel you've sort of got gold dust if you do sort of stumble on a kind of a sort of diary, say, of somebody at the grassroots. So you're continually struggling with how you interpret the sort of official sources that may incidentally tell you quite a lot about the sort of experience of the marginalised, but are not necessarily from the point of view of those people themselves. Mm-hmm. I mean, the 1851 census is again quite a good example of that. It's returns supplied by clergy and others of what was going on, of attendance in their churches. I mean, they may have views as to which they sometimes state in the remarks section as to when and why people come to church or don't come to church. But it's their perspective. So there's quite a lot of sort of interpretation and jigsaw building to be done.
Indeed.
But I think I'm still fascinated by, I mean, the impact of the individual on religious and indeed sort of general history. I think it's important that we thinking of the role of the sort of seemingly insignificant individual as well as of the sort of great man or indeed great woman.
Yeah, well, that leads perfectly into what I think will probably be our last question. You talked in your presentation yesterday a great deal about the public benefit, the use of historical approaches in public engagement. I wondered if you wanted to talk to us about that.
Yes, indeed. I do think, I mean, history can be of tremendous value in engaging with a society that is sometimes looking for roots and can, I think, sometimes be a bit uncritical in its search for roots, that people want an identity and may be clutching at something that can be a bit confrontational. I mean, for example, Muslims looking for an identity that is perhaps rooted in current conflicts in the Middle East, rather than reflecting on what is actually quite a long standing presence in British society and culture. So I think a history of public engagement by historians of religion that uncovers some of those hidden histories, I think can be a very positive force. It can also sort of encourage religious organisations themselves to think about how they've changed in the past and therefore to think sort of strategically about the future. And also to think critically and constructively about sort of their physical resources, for example. I mean, how do you see a sort of historic Anglican church building as an opportunity rather than a burden? If you're a newer religious group that has an adopted building, then what might you learn about its history and former uses that could actually make you perhaps more comfortable with your current usage of it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And one last question, if I may. I mean, what are some of the perhaps the dangers, or no, I mean, not dangers is too strong a word, but some of the pitfalls and problems perhaps in this approach. Do we have a danger of reifying quite a messy picture into a too cohesive a narrative? Do you see what I'm saying?
Well, I mean, this is always the challenge for historians, but I mean, you want to sort of create some kind of order out of a very messy and complex past, and that in a part is your job. You sort of want to establish to clarify what the pattern is. I think I agree. It's a particular challenge when you come to sort of engagement with a wider public that may want a sort of simple message to be told sort of straightforward things they can easily assimilate about the past, and the academic is always wanting to say, well, the past is actually more complicated than you might like to think it is. So I think there's actually quite a tightrope, but I think a creative tightrope that we have to walk between, on the one hand, telling people things about the past that they can relate to, identify with, and understand. And on the other, avoiding the risk of oversimplifying, which then sort of you may, in doing so, knock old myths on the head, but you sort of then risk sort of creating your new ones.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I think it's a sort of creative ongoing process.
Great. Well, I want to say thanks very much, John, for doing this interview with us under considerable time restraints. It's been a very interesting interview, and I'm sure a lot of people will find that of great benefit. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks.
So thanks very much for that interview there, David. It was really interesting, and as always, it's really good to just hear about the importance of using historical perspective in our work, because so much, in fact, someone commented at the BASR conference that we were just at, I think it was our colleague Dr. Naomi Appleton, who actually said that so much of the conference was on contemporary religion, contemporary this, everyday this, very, very, she said she could almost count on one hand the amount of sort of historical papers that there were, but every one of those everyday papers, say, should have some form of historical context.
There's a couple of things to say there. First of all is that historical doesn't mean historic, and but you do point to an interesting thing, which is contemporary religions tend to be studied sociologically, whereas mm-hmm. the classical religions tend to be studied historiographically. Actually, that's something that we need to challenge. And a good example of that is, in fact, the work of Ronald Hutton, who was the first to really treat Wicca from the point of view of an objective historian. And so let's turn to his interview now and get a little bit more of a specific case study in the application of historiographic methodologies.
Perfect.
One of the great myths of modern pagan historiography is that my researchers, Ronald Hutton, demolished the foundation myth of Wicca.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, my research was produced to fill a vacuum caused by the collapse of the foundation myth of Wicca before I'd ever come on the scene. The foundation myth was based upon absolutely orthodox professional scholarship, which was dominant in British universities in the mid-20th century. It was born on the continent among German and French scholars. It was fully formed by the end of the 19th century, and it depended on the idea that the people prosecuted for the alleged crime of witchcraft in the early modern period were practitioners of a surviving pagan religion, which had been wiped out in the witch trials. The only addition made to that myth in the 20th century was when Gerald Gardner came along in the 1950s and told the world that the religion concerned hadn't been wiped out and had survived, hidden among a few families until the 20th century. And he was broadcasting its continued existence and inviting people to rejoin it if they wished. This idea was given an added boost in Britain by the work of the Egyptologist Margaret Murray, who supplied a wealth of apparent detail to back it up. But this was simply adding to something which was fully established by about 1900. And scholars as well-known and justly distinguished as Christopher Hill, Sir Stephen Runciman, and many of the authors of the classic textbooks like the Oxford History of England regarded it as the truth and told the public that it was the truth. So this was laid wide open to demolition as soon as sustained research into the history of the witch trials began using original records. And that started around about 1970 and has just gathered pace since. And within a few years of 1970, those engaged in it realised that there was absolutely no evidence that the people engaged in the trials for witchcraft on either side were pagans, certainly not the victims. That gradually trickled through to pagan leaders in England, especially those who were the founders of Wicca and their immediate successors. And by 1990, it was largely accepted that the Gerald Gardner line was not correct. But that did leave, as a huge, wide-open question, the problem of where Wicca had come from in that case. And what my research and Triumph was intended to do was to plug that gap, to give pagans who'd been deprived of their history, because it had been an academic history which later academics had refuted, some sense of their relation to their past and to their parent society. And what Triumph did was not to waste a great deal of time on demolishing a myth of origins that had already gone in Britain, but to point out that it could be historically documented that Wicca and other forms of pagan witchcraft were an extreme distillation of some extremely powerful forces in modern British society, which affected some of our greatest artists and writers and thinkers, from Keats and Shelley onwards, through Rider Haggard and Kenneth Graham and Algernon Swinburne, right through to the present. So the horned god of Wicca is the god Pan, who became the Victorian's favourite god in English literature. The image of the goddess as a deity of the green earth and the night sky is very much the goddess form of the Romantic movement, adopted in the British imagination in particular since the early 19th century. The basic forms, the rituals, are taken from Freemasonry and its Victorian esoteric offshoots. The ritual magic is part of an utterly unbroken heterodox tradition which had been on the go since ancient Egypt. And its view of history and its view of folklore and its view of witchcraft were taken from the greatest minds researching into those fields round about 1900. So all that was unorthodox about modern pagan witches is they put this lot together to produce a sensationally countercultural religion, which was nonetheless completely viable, very English, and founded, as said, upon some very widespread cultural traits. So that was what I set out to do. I think I accomplished it, and that so far not a single professional scholar has found fault with the basic premises of the work. There'll no doubt be some fine-tuning. And I never did solve the question of where Wicca itself directly came from, because the evidence isn't there. I helped inspire others, such as Philip Heselton, to go out and delve a bit further into personal records and produce a wealth of fascinating data, for which I and everybody else are hugely grateful to them, or should be, but didn't actually manage fully to explain how Wicca had come about. I couldn't find the proof of anything, and neither could they, so it remains, I think, an unsolved historical riddle. But although the details can be enlarged, and although some of those precise questions can't be answered, I think the basic outline standing back of the development of modern British paganism is retrievable by scholars, and I think that the picture in Triumph is basically right and can be filled out a lot further. There's an immense amount of extra work that can be done on Victorian and Edwardian paganism. There's an awful lot of material. It's a bit of a shame in a way that apparently a lot of modern pagans, especially pagan witches the present day, are still fixated upon the medieval early modern period, which is fine in itself, except they do it instead of being interested in the 19th, early 20th centuries, when there is so much that can be recovered, and such wonderful sources as well, especially in really good poetry and ritual texts and sociological documents. Among historians, there is one further division which I think is closing, and that is that English-speaking historians, that's really British and American for the most part, have tended to be interested in the psychology and the criminology and the sociology of the early modern witch trials, but have been rather allergic to looking at the pagan elements in witch belief. That is to say, not that the people accused of witchcraft were practicing pagans, but that the stereotype of the witch to which they were fitted does contain some very ancient elements, not least because the ancient world believed in witches by the definition of a person who uses magic to cause harm to others, just as much or even more than Christian Europe did. So no doubt and no wonder ancient elements reappear. But on the continent, this research of looking at the ancient elements has been extremely fruitful. The Italians, the Germans, and the Hungarians have been most prominent. Carlo Ginzburg and his school in Italy, Wolfgang Beringer in Germany, and Eva Pox and Klenisei Gabor in Hungary. These are the great names. My only problem with their attitude is that, although I think it's really valuable and fruitful, it's tended to universalise ancient belief under this catch-all umbrella term of shamanism, which has its virtues in linking together widely disparate sorts of belief, but can paper over quite strongly contrasting regional traditions of magic and the supernatural, which explain important things like why people tended to be prosecuted for witchcraft more in some areas than others, why women were the majority accused in some parts and men in the others, and so forth. I'd really like to see the two schools, the English-speaking and the continental, come together a bit more to share perceptions and give us a better rounded picture of ancient paganism. And another spin-off from the history of modern paganism, which could really help scholars, is to look at the material evidence for magic. OK, archaeologists have always been good with solid objects, because that's by definition what they tend to dig up. Historians, not so much so. There's been a tendency to disregard material evidence altogether, even works of art. And although that's dissolving in certain areas, the physical evidence for magic is something for which there is vast quantities of material in Britain, at least, elsewhere as well, but Britain I know about, which has never been properly studied by large numbers of professional academics. The pioneers in the field tend to be from outside the university system or on the fringe of it. And they've done wonderful work, which is hardly yet known or understood by mainstream historians or archaeologists of the medieval and early modern period. And that's another way in which the integration of this evidence, material evidence which modern pagans are pretty familiar because they use the latter-day descendants of these traditions and processes and working tools, can play a large part.
In Britain, I think the Gardiner and Murray kind of idea is pretty well accepted as being problematic. But I think you've come under a lot more criticism in the States. Is that correct?
Yes. What I'd politely call Wiccan counter-revisionism, that's an attempt to hang on to the idea of witchcraft as a surviving pagan religion, is much stronger in the English-speaking former colonies and dominions than it is in the homeland now, above all in America. There are a number of reasons for this. Some people suggest simply that forms of religion tend to be more fundamentalist and more accentuated in colonies than they are in homelands. It could well be true. I can see simpler explanations. The first is simply that there are many more Americans in America and New Zealand by head of population than there are in Britain now. And so you get much more diversity among them. It's noticeable that in America, counter-revisionism is concentrated far more in the centre and the west of the country than in New England, New York, the areas most closely associated with Britain. And also that in every area of these other nations in which you find counter-revisionism, you find lots of pagans, possibly more, who accept the revisionist model. So in many ways, what this is not really Americans against me or against British revisionism, so much as a dialogue between different sorts of American, Australian and New Zealander pagans. But another reason why it's more likely to be found there is that pagans are usually more recent converts in these nations. And so the people who are reacting now are people who in the last 10 or 20 years came into paganism believing the foundation myth. And then works like Triumph arrived from Britain and looked like an assault on their beliefs. In other words, there was no gap between the collapse of the old model and the arrival of the new one. Whereas in Britain, the new model was there to fill a gap. And so it was much more welcome.
Yeah.
So there's much more of what we call cognitive dissonance.
Yeah. What about the connection, the strong connection to feminism in the US through figures like Starhawk? Does that mean that the Murray thesis is more important to them, perhaps?
I don't think there's any reason why the strong connection between pagan witchcraft and feminism in the USA should have any problems with historical revisionism, because whatever happens, the figure of the witch is going to remain one of the few traditional images of female power that our parent societies bequeath us. So the witch is going to remain a feminist issue and a feminist icon across Europe. Personally, I've never had any trouble from the great founding figures of American traditions. Never had a quarrel with Starhawk or Z Budapest. Never had anything but excellent relations with Oberon and Morning Glory, Zell and Margot Adler and the great New York and New England Wiccan traditions. Above all, overwhelmingly, Wiccan counter-revisionists are newcomers. They're people who've come on the scene relatively recently and are striving to present themselves as champions of a tradition which they've just taken on.
One last question for you, or prompt, perhaps. Your work and the work of the late Goodrich Clark are my favourite examples of how historical research can really bring to light... They can make a story actually far more interesting when we learn the complexity of all these connections. I just wondered if you'd like to close with any comments or thoughts, advice on doing historiography on these controversial religious subjects.
Well, two things about research into historiography of modern paganism. The first is there's vast amounts of material out there that have never been touched. It's a great subject for any first-time researcher, or indeed any researcher who wants a new field and cross over. And the second point is that the material itself is intensely exciting. It ranges from great poetry to secret societies to hidden or semi-hidden folk beliefs. It's great detective work. It's a nice combination for anybody who wants a subject which is going to form an academic career and never bore you on the way.
So I think you actually raised one question in that interview there, David, did you? Something.
It was, again, because of the time, I discussed what I wanted him to say as we were walking practically to the room, knowing that I had exactly 15 minutes.
That was fantastic.
So originally, I intended to edit the questions in later. It was all to save time, but in the end, I think it comes across perfectly well. Luckily, he was obliging and professional enough to be able to just go into
it.
The questions that you heard me asking towards the end were ones that he gave me extra time and allowed me to ask a couple of things which had occurred to me.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's fantastic when that happens with scholars. So, you've heard there are two interviews that we brought you in our first week, and what we're going to do... on Wednesday this week, since we had an interview, we recorded in our sort of, let's say, first semester of the Religious Studies Project with Callum Brown on historical approaches to losing religion, or to the sort of broad sort of secularisation idea. And we thought on Wednesday what we're going to do, we'll re-broadcast that podcast for you, so you can take all three of these interviews in one. And reflect on that, but then also we'll put out with that Dr. Tim Hutchings' response to Callum Brown as well, so we'll put those out on Wednesday for you.
Yeah, and that's going to be really interesting, and you know, we weren't without our issues with Callum Brown's approach, but I think it certainly is an interesting approach, and I think these three together will make an interesting overview.
Yeah. So, we haven't mentioned our sponsors yet. We've mentioned them in passing, but we are brought to you, of course, by the British Association for the Study of Religions, to whom we are forever grateful.
And there'll be a little bit more about them in next week's introduction, because we'll be talking about the conference we recently returned from.
But for now...
Well, hopefully, if you're listening to this, you should have accessed it through our New Look Web 2.0 website.
This has been put together for us by our assistant editor, Knut, who we had the pleasure of meeting face-to-face for the first time in Liverpool last week. And what this is, it's this week it's a more of an aesthetic change So hopefully, you know, the functionality should be almost exactly as it was before, but the look and feel of the site will have changed. But over the coming weeks, we're going to be rolling out some changes in functionality, improved search functions, different audio players and things like that. So bear with us. We do understand that these changes can be traumatic, but hopefully we're going to make everything, you know, much better for everyone involved, better, particularly the sort of searching and archiving. But it's also a prime time for you to raise any issues that you have had with the old site that you might like improved upon.
And yeah, I think you've said it all really about the site. There's bound to be a few niggles over the first few weeks, but let us know and we'll get those sorted.
And massive kudos to Knut.
Massive kudos to Knut, yes. And also there'll be a lot of things are going on behind the scenes to improve the usability of the site for the contributors, which will enable the assistant editors to be much more involved in the day-to-day running of the site.
Before I mention what's going to happen next week, you have to sit through another mini advertisement, of course. You can support the Religious Studies Project by using our amazon.co.uk and .com links. We've had comparatively little traffic through these, and it's just a really simple way that you can support the project without having to pay anything extra. Just if you're going to shop on Amazon, just click through from there and we'll get a percentage. If everyone who listened to the podcast did that, we'd be able to fund ourselves, I think, for the next 100 years.
Indeed.
No exaggeration.
Indeed. Nonetheless, the project's going strength to strength. We have podcasts recorded right up until and scheduled right up until the new year, with a lot more to come. We'll talk a little bit more about that next week, after next week's interview, which is the turn of my associate Chris Cotter.
Yeah, so I will be bringing you an interview I recorded with our good friend, Professor Carol Cusack of the University of Sydney.
Our number one fan.
Yes. I think there is not a single podcast that Carol hasn't listened to, which is more than either of us could maybe.
Don't spoil the illusion.
Don't spoil the illusion. Don't look at the man behind the curtain. So we're talking about the broad topic of religion and cultural production, which is on the back of her co-edited volume with Brill, The Handbook of New Religions and Cultural Production, to which David contributed a chapter. But you'll hear more about that next week.
So, yeah, for now, shall we just say
thanks for listening.